If somebody came up and said they didn't have slides, and they didn't have maps, and they didn't have videos, and I don't have any of those things either, and I don't even have my speech. I sat up last night till 2 in the morning writing a speech, and then I came and I listened to the dialogue today, and I basically kind of thought that extemporaneous is better. I want to do at least 10 or 15 minutes of Q&A with the folks here, but I also want to kind of have a chance to share with you maybe a different perspective. I don't know quite as much about technology as some of you. I know nothing about production, but I know a lot about Washington, and I know a lot about public policy, and have a pretty good sense of where this nation should go, and maybe a little bit of a sense of where we are going to go. I spent 10 years of my life on Capitol Hill. The first 4 years with a young man named Mickey Leland, who tragically died in Africa trying to feed folks in Ethiopia, and flew his plane into a mountain. I then spent 6 years of my life working for Ed Markey. And while with Ed Markey, I had a chance to work on the development of ITVS. And one of the great Twitters, I saw the Twitter while we were sitting there, was one of the folks was talking about agendas. And one of the people in the Twitter said, you know, ITVS got started because four people with an agenda in the independent production community cared. And they came to Washington with an agenda. And I want to expound on those a little bit during my discussion today. But one of the things that I want to say right up front is it's not enough to have an agenda. You have to have an agenda that you can articulate. You have to have people who can advocate it. And you've got to be able to break it down so that your mother and your grandmother understand what you're saying. Because as I was listening to so much was going on in here, what you have to understand is that the average staffer, the average member of Congress, the average person in the Commerce Department, even if they care deeply about what you're doing, they don't have anywhere near the depth of knowledge of what this industry is doing, what this community is doing, as you do. And so you're going to speak in acronyms and talk about technologies that they may have experienced, but they don't fully understand. So as you're thinking, as I'm speaking, be thinking about how do you take what you know and what you do, and how do you explain it to folks who may support you, but aren't aware of how they can best support you. I'm like the only guy here in a suit and a tie, so as you may have figured out, I'm a lawyer. And I don't think you can have a meeting in D.C. without at least one lawyer. And I'm that it today. And I started to wear an open shirt, and it's actually Pat's fault, because I went online and saw that whoever's the keynote last year had on a suit and tie. So I decided to throw it on. And the other reason is I'm not really in a hurry today, but there is one place I am going to go. One of I had the good fortune for about 4 months to be a neighbor of Tim Russert's. And for those of you who don't know, he lived over in Woodley Park, which is about a mile from which is where I lived, and his wake is today from 2 to 9. So for those of you who care, he was one of the last bastions of civility and objectivity, in my opinion. I get tired of the screaming heads, and while I don't always agree with Tim Russert, what I thought he did do was he brought in objectivity, and I very much worry about the level of public discourse on commercial television when you start seeing the screamers and the ranters and the folks who aren't asking hard questions, don't really know much but have strong opinions anyway. So I'm hoping that at some point today I'll have a chance to stop by, and I thought it would be inappropriate not to wear a suit because he always wore a suit. I was trying to think about what I should talk about, and I got rid of my speech, and I spent a lot of time on the Hill, and I'm a little older than most of the people in the room, not as old as some, and I still have this teletopian vision of technology. And what's interesting is that we've always had this teletopian vision of technology. I hear so much when people talk about how we can use these technologies for good, to make this world a better place, to educate every American, to bring more people into participatory form of democracy. We can make it more democratic with small d, we can make it more inclusive. And I think that if you go back to the 1927 Radio Act, the 1934 Communications Act, the advent of public television, the advent of the internet, the advent of cable television, advent of broadband, at every twist and turn, in every part of the evolution of telecommunications, we've said basically the same thing. And somehow, every time we've allowed commercial voices to kind of drown out which is the best of what we have to offer. We've never reached that teletopian vision, not because people haven't aspired to it, but somehow it always gets lost in the race for dollars and power. I think Washington operates on fear and greed, but I think most of media does too. But we have a chance to reshuffle the deck one more time. And I have to think, I'm on the board of ITVS, I was on the board of ITVS, and it's great to see Sally and Claire and Kevin and so many people I shared that experience with, not to mention Pat. But I'm also on the board of the Annenberg School, the board of counselors at Dean Wilson. And Dean Wilson teed up a lot of what I want to say. Because I love public broadcasting, and yet I understand all of the problems with public broadcasting, or some of them anyway, and I love public media, And I think we're going to run into some of the same problems if we're not very, very careful. You know, commercialism. Diane Myrmex, I've known her forever. I've read her stuff forever. And we both read the same thing yesterday about PBS and Hulu. And she looks at it as an opportunity, and I read it with dread. I absolutely read it with dread. I read it with dread because I know what happens when you go to creeping commercialism. I don't have a problem with advertising. I don't have a problem with commercial television. But I think there's got to be a commercial space and a non-commercial space. And I think if we don't have that non-commercial space, if there isn't a place that's about selling you widgets or propounding an idea of a corporate interest or selling your children sugared candies or trying to promote a political agenda that's paid for as opposed to a discursive political agenda, I think we lose something as a nation. When you start talking about who's an underwriter and who's a sponsor, I know we have to do it, and we have to have a debate and dialogue about how you get the dollars. I heard the point about it is important to do great things, but those great things cost money. I understand that, but it doesn't mean we have to sell out to commercial interests. Trust me, as somebody who's worked in government and who works for people who try to influence government now and who has occasionally, although I'm not a registered lobbyist, actually written op-eds or other things because I believe I need to influence government because they're going down the wrong path, generally people have agendas when they give you money. There is no such thing as free money. And if you are a media outlet and somebody's giving you money, trust me, it's because they want something from you or your audience. It is a very slippery slope. It does not mean that it is always awful, but if we start letting commercial dictates get in front, we're going to have a problem as a nation. And there's a second problem about letting advertising and commercial aspects of our community drive what gets on public media and public interest media. The reality is some of us in this nation are valued more highly than others. Now, I happen to be an African American and I happen to be a lawyer. I happen to live in Woodley Park with the 2008 zip code. But the reality is that for a lot of people who make advertising decisions every day, despite my income and education and zip code, I am valued less than a person who makes a lot less who lives in Loudoun County. I listen to a black radio station. If you look at the ad buys for black radio or urban radio or Hispanic radio, you look at the ad buys for quote-unquote traditional media, country and western, a country and western station in America that has the exact same ratings as an urban-oriented station in America gets a lot less money. That's just the reality. Talk to anybody who's ever booked sales for commercial radio stations. Advertisers value some of us more highly than others of us. And the reality is gender and race have a large degree to do. For you women, you actually value more highly most of the time because there's a thought that you make the purchasing decisions. So as a black male or as a Latino male, we are the lowest in the pecking order. There is a problem there when you start saying, okay, let's let ad dollars drive this. So when Diane says, well, we can go to people, you can start this process, you can get dollars into the system, some types of programming will be supported, some types of programming won't be supported. And by the way, if somebody is giving you dollars and you go get too close to a line of thought that they don't agree with, Kellogg's is supporting you, and I love Kellogg Foundation, and I eat cornflakes, but if Kellogg's is supporting you, and you start talking about some of the problems with ethanol in your documentary, do you think that maybe some of that, even though it's a cornflake side of, it's the Rice Krispie side of Kellogg that's supporting you, do you think that Kellogg might want to have a conversation with you about, this corn thing, you're getting a little too close to something we care about? Those are issues that every one of us here has to constantly be aware of when we start talking about commercialism. Let me talk a little bit about demographics, because that's the elephant in the room, something we never talk about. Dean Wilson teed it up very nicely. The reality is, and he was nicer than I'm going to be, maybe, because he said that a lot of public broadcasters care about people from 1 till 7, and then from 46 to till the day after you die. But he actually said that they care about all people from 1 to 7. And it indicated that they even care about people of color from 46 to the day they die. Actually, people of color from 46 are relevant to them, too. And public broadcasting needs to think about two separate things. They need to think about aging, and they need to think about what's happening in this nation. This nation is undergoing a profound demographic change that public broadcasting does not reflect in any manner. We're a nation right now, in 1995, when I was on the Hill, this nation was 78% non-Hispanic white. That's 13 years ago, 1995. Today, we are 68% non-Hispanic white. By 2050, we will be 49% non-Hispanic white, meaning Asians, blacks, Native Americans, Latinos will be 51% of this nation. If you look at the skewing of public broadcasting, the median age of public broadcasting viewers is 46 years old. median age of this country is 36 years old. The median age of Latinos in this country is 24 years old. We're going to grow by 137 million people between 1995 and 2050. 90% of that growth will be people of color. Now, you know, Michael Jordan once said that he's a better basketball player than everybody else because he plays to where the ball is going to be. Actually, Michael Jordan didn't say that. Wayne Gretzky said it, but, you know, he talked about a puck. But I like to use Michael Jordan because Michael Jordan made it possible for a tall, bald black man to be a sex symbol in America. I gotta love the brother. And I once said that in front of my wife, who Ernest knows, and my wife said, yeah, and if you had $500 million in a jump shot, you'd be sexy too. But for public broadcasting, they need to kind of figure out where the ball is going to be. If you look at most of the programs, not that there aren't some great programming tranches, not that there's some great programming threads, not that there aren't some great individual producers who get on, but the system in and of itself has no brand equity in my community. I've been in the projects in Brooklyn. I grew up in Queens in a low-income, working-class community. Trust me, when we go out to the playground, nobody said, yo, man, did you listen to All Things Considered this morning? Hey, did you see that loud? It never happened. But when, you know, I will go to cocktail parties in Washington, D.C. among other lawyers, and I will get that question. It's like, I do get who they're trying to get at. And that's the problem with dollars, and that's the problem with commercialism. There's a reason that so much of what you see on public broadcasting is what it is. Part of it's they're going to certain foundations, to certain types of folks with money who want that kind of programming. Second, when they do their pledge drives, it's interesting that I see more stuff about black folks doing the pledge drives. They'll throw some rock and roll stuff on there. They'll throw, you know, a Nat King Cole special. They're trying to get a brother to drive a check. But for the most part, I'm ignored as a person of color. As an American, I'm covered. As a person who has some interest, I'm covered. As a person of color, I'm somehow lost. They don't quite get it. And forget about Latinos. I mean, the Spanish population in this country, no one seems to care in public broadcasting. I love Sharon Rockefeller. I love WETA. They're going to do a program on Latino Americans in 2011. I mean, I know there's a lead time, but like, you know, so from 1967 to 2011, the only time we hear about Latinos when they're bitching and moaning about the World War II movie documentary, we got to do better than this. And if folks in this community don't pick up that cudgel and say, yo, as public media, as public broadcasting, as the public, we want this to be inclusive of everyone, not just 1 to 7, not just 46 to 98, but everyone in this country needs to be part of this revolution, then we're somehow dropping the ball ourselves. And if you don't care about it because you want to do the right thing, pick up today's newspaper and see what's happening with XM Sirius and realize that black voters and brown voters are only going to have more political power. And I don't care what happens in XM Sirius. I really don't have Sirius. I like it. I pay my $12 or whatever it is a month, and I hope that it continues to exist because I actually like the ability to go to an all-jazz station, to an all-news station. On XM, I get in the rental cars, and I like the POTUS 80, POTUS 08. I hope it exists. But a number of black members of Congress said, yo, hold it. You're going to sell this thing off, and you're going to increase consolidation, and you're not making enough space for black and brown and programmers and women to have space on this. And if you don't deal with us correctly, we're going to stop this. Now, maybe they will, maybe they won't. But as demographics change, members of Congress will change. And it is not an accident. You know, when I was growing up, the safest thing to be in America was a Southern Democrat member of Congress. The safest thing today in America to be is a member of Congress who is a person of color. They don't lose their seats. You're going to see a lot more chairmen of a lot more committees who are people who look like me. And the reality is, if you're not dealing with issues that reflect the interests of the people in their communities, they are going to be very unhappy. When public broadcasting next year comes up for reauthorization, there are going to be a number of people who are black or brown who are in positions of authority in the Appropriations Committee or Authorization Committee. And when you say we need $400 or $500 or $600 or $1 billion, we want to have a dialogue about how we're changing public media, they're going to say, and exactly how are you serving our community and why does this matter to me? What are you doing about employment? What are you doing about producers and production? What are you doing about being part of the community? Where are you located? How often do you have fora about your programming that bring in people in my community? Some folks do this wonderfully. There are some stations that are exemplary, and there's some that are absolutely horrific. And the system as a whole, let's say they could use some improvement. These are debates that folks have got to start thinking about realistically. You know, technology has been interesting because I've been here all day and I haven't heard anybody talking about wireless or very little discussion about wireless. I probably watch as much television on something that looks like this, it's actually in my sling box, I use Slingbox, the Sling technology. How many of you all know what Slingbox is? Right, so for those of you who don't, I have DirecTV and I have cable at my home. And I connect that to my DSL, and I can basically sling 500 channels plus a video, plus all my audio channels, which is XM, anywhere I am where I have broadband. So as long as I have my little phone or my laptop is connected to broadband, I was literally watching Stanford lose again in basketball while sitting in Bangalore, India. Sitting in India, got a broadband connection to Bangalore Hyatt, and I'm sitting there, Mumbai Hyatt, and I remember this well, it was traumatic. And I watched Stanford lose yet another NCAA game because I'm sitting over there doing that. Slingbox allows me to watch television anywhere I want to. And what brought this to mind was yesterday, remember the horrific rainstorm? Well, I was trying to get from my office back to my home, and I take the metro. And I had my little Slingbox because I wanted to watch Tiger. So when you're self-employed, you can do these things. So I decided to leave before the storm to get home so I could watch Tiger. Had my little Slingbox out. And what was interesting is I noticed there were two other brothers. One had it on his phone and one had his laptop watching Tiger in the metro on his Slingbox. The point is, for an entire generation of people, technology isn't something that you have to go to. Appointment television is dead. You carry it with you. You go where you want to go. You watch it when you want to watch it. And we've got to start thinking about technology as it is. And I no longer use the term new media. I read an op-ed in March of this year. New media is media. Media, you know, when you talk to a young kid, there was a survey that came out 2 days ago by a group called Topics, I think. And what they basically said is that 76% of kids would give up television before they give up the internet. They'd rather watch a full-length program online or at least they'd like to watch a full-length program online, one-hour program, as they would on their television set. If you ask me, they'd rather talk to somebody on the telephone or they'd rather text message them, they'd rather text them. This is not, if you're under 25, this net, this web, this isn't something that's foreign to you. This is you. And we're still thinking about it as something new, as something different. If we don't begin to understand that it's internalized, that it's not about new media versus old media, this is the media for everybody coming up. Remember that 50% of Latinos, you know, are under 24. It's something like 40% of African Americans are under 28. I mean, for the younger demographic coming up, this is what they understand. Oh, and by the way, blacks and browns consume more media of every type than do Anglo-Americans, even if you adjust for income. Low-income African Americans are more likely to use voice minutes, to use features on their cell phone, to have video on their cell phones, to have pay-per-view, because they are very entertainment-driven communities. I said 6 years ago, the NBA Technology Summit, if you wanted to sell computers and the internet to black and brown kids, have Allen Iverson on a TV commercial with his laptop showing how he stays in touch with other boys on the court, how he follows what his agents are doing, how he gets his new clothing designed on that, and throw that commercial up online. Well, Allen Iverson has tats, so nobody's ready to do that yet, but they do have Serena Williams with almost exactly that commercial, if you've seen it for Hewlett Packard, and by the way, it's moving product because that commercial is still on a year later. The reality is you can get to folks, and this community can get to folks, and if you want to engage them, reach them where they are. Understand that this device is as important to them as the television is, and as you're trying to figure out how you're going to produce your product, make sure that you have an idea of how to use this. We're going to have a debate next year in this town about white spaces, which is additional wireless spectrum that can allow for all kinds of innovative uses. Everybody in this room should be thinking about how do we get there. Now, we have never before had a revolution like this wireless revolution. 3 billion people around this planet have wireless technology. 500 million people in China, 300 million people in India. We're third in the world. 8 million new people joined the Chinese wireless net. 9 million new people joined the Indian wireless net in January and February of this year. This is the only time we've ever had a revolution of technology that happened simultaneously around the world. If we really want to connect the world in terms of public media, let's understand that too. And how do we incorporate all of the things that are happening all over this globe simultaneously into our analysis, into our thought process, into our structure of public media in this country? I could go on about wireless, but I won't, because I want to get to one other thing before I turn to questions and answers. And that's Dennis Harshager, who I didn't know before today, but who is now my new best friend, mentioned something that I thought was really important. Back in January, I read, I was very sick, and I'd come out of surgery, and I was going through Washington Post, catching up some magazines, and I saw the NPR.org and what they were doing with interactive media, and I was really excited about it. And then a month later, I noticed that they fired the CEO. And I was worried that the stations had finally figured out, oh, no, we're not, you're not going to drag us kicking and screaming into the 21st century. We want to be 19th century, damn it, and you're not going to make us be 20th, much less 21st. Well, after listening to Dennis, I have less fear about that. Because Dennis and I have a common goal, and I think a common thread. Dean Wilson talked about silos. Back in 1998, when AOL was still very relevant, there was a young woman named Jill Lesson, who was their chief lobbyist, and she and I went off to have lunch. And we talked about this thing called, we call then green spaces. We'd never use the term now because green spaces mean something else. And how do we create a space where public institutions and public media can coalesce, can aggregate their assets in order to make sure that people know what's online? How do we give a trusted brand to people? And how do we get public broadcasters to play nice in that space? I still think that that's the kind of idea we have. Whether it's museums or libraries or public media, we need to take the best brands, bring them together, and have them work together. And, you know, when I was sick and I was looking for information, I happen to have had cancer, and I'm in remission, I'm going to live, and all that good stuff. But when I was looking for information about cancer just on Google, all I found was a whole bunch of stuff that talked about seek help and trying to sell me pills that weren't going to work. There was no trusted source I could go to online. Well, what if Sibley Hospital and GW Hospital and the Washington Library had a health section for people in Washington, particularly people who don't have a level of digital literacy that I have, that I know I could go there, get the information I want, and it's a trusted source from public sources. Oh, and by the way, it's interactive. Because, by the way, public broadcasting does an absolutely abysmal job of public broadcasting, of interactive. So those of you in this room who understand interactivity can work with those of who have a brand and who have a space and have the technological capacity and maybe the resources to make this happen. I don't know where this dialogue is going to go, but I hope that Dennis and I understand that the Berkman Center and others are beginning to think about how do we bring this to fruition? How do we take all of these great public institutions in this country, all of the great people who are public-spirited, have a public-mindedness about them, and bring them to a dialogue together? How do we set that agenda and then bring it to members of Congress and to the new administration? In January, you're going to have 20 to 30 new Democrats in the House. Bank on it, unless something unforeseen happens. You're going to have 3 to 7 new Democrats in the Senate. Bank on it, unless something happens. Most of them are predisposed to be helpful in this agenda, although most of them are also clueless about what it means to be helpful. As I was clueless when ITVS came to me, they need to be informed. They're not stupid people. This isn't what they do. This is what you do. Explain it to them. Set the agenda. Create a template that makes sense for them. And there's one other thing that should happen, and I hope will happen. You know, a friend of mine happened to be the Prime Minister of Australia. You know, figure it out. He was like, I was a staffer, he was a staffer. He grew up to be Prime Minister. I grew up to live in Woodley Park. But, you know, but I love Kevin. What Kevin did was he brought 200 of the smartest people in Australia together to just talk about stuff. How can we make Australia better? One of the things I hope the next president will do will bring 10 or 15 people, 20 people, to talk about public media, talk about the role of technology in American life, talk about how we can use these tools for the betterment of America. I hope that that president and whoever's in there won't ask about money. There are a lot of people who have great ideas, but you turn them off because what you first thing you do when you turn to them is you're talking to them about money instead of all the other things they have to offer. A guy like Rob Glaser can offer you money, but he built real networks. A guy like Mark Cuban, you can talk about money, he's built HDNet and Broadcast.com. You can talk to people like Mr. Skoll, you can talk to people like Mr. Midian, they know technology. How do you bring those people together at a presidential level, not taking a lot of their time, not as much money, but how do we get from where we are to where we want to be? We did something very similar with the National Information Infrastructure Advisory Committee. We had horrible acronyms back in the Clinton days. But we did bring a lot of people together, and we did advance the ball, and the TOP, later TOP program, and other things came out of that. What I'm hoping is that the next president will start thinking about how do we bring all of our public institutions together. We'll get the best minds from this country who understand technology at a high level, can make things happen, come in and explain what needs to happen, and have their staffers continue. And start, you know, you have a meeting at the beginning, you have a meeting in the middle, you have a meeting at the end, you have 3 meetings over 3 months because of internet speed. We did it in a year, they need to do it in 3 months. And in between, they use the net that's a closed network just for them. And then that stuff can be public, is made public immediately afterwards. We have a quick discourse, and 6 months after, we actually start doing things on Capitol Hill. I mean, that may be the wrong template, maybe the wrong timing, but how do we get the best we have in America to start thinking about how we can use technology to work for every American? About 40 years ago, in March, Martin Luther King gave a speech right here in Washington, D.C. And in that speech, he said something, the only thing I'll read today rather than speaking is he said there can be no gainsaying of the fact that a great revolution is taking place in the world today. It is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. We have made distance irrelevant and put time in chains. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. The mapping technologies that you guys are doing and gals are doing are defining the neighborhood. What we need to do over the next 6 to 12 to 18 months is use this technology, use what we're learning, and try to use this technology to make this country a little bit more of a brotherhood. Thank you very much.